Welcome to the Ghost Podcast. Today we have a guest that I'm really excited to introduce. You have heard me talk about him and his podcast on previous episodes. Peter McGraw, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Peter McGraw is a bachelor, a behavioral economist, and he hosts the podcast solo. And Peter, you also have a book coming out soon. Can you tell me about that?
I can. And this is my first announcement with a new subtitle. So my publisher came along and said, we don't like your subtitle, which was, well, the title of the book's called Solo, not surprisingly. Right. And the subtitle was Breaking the Rules in a World Built for Two. You know, punchy and controversial and sassy. Now it's a more sellable title, I'm told. Building a Remarkable Life of Your Own.
I like both of them, actually, but I kind of prefer the first one. I mean, I like the positive spin on the building the remarkable life part.
Yes.
But I also like the first one, how you talk about breaking the mold of two, because that's an important concept to all of the things that you talk about.
Yes. I think that it's growing on me. I would say that it is a better subtitle, Building a Remarkable Life of Your Own, for someone who doesn't know the solo movement. But I think if you're part of the solo movement, you really like breaking the rules in a world built for two.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of exploring. You know, obviously I started with the book Sex at Dawn, and, you know, I have a lot of poly friends and I'm in the poly community and just learning a lot more about undoing this thought process that has been imposed on us by religion and the patriarchy for years and years. And so a friend of mine recommended your podcast to me, and I think he sent it to me because I always said that I practice relationship anarchy, but I never really liked the term that much for a lot of the reasons that you talk about. So when you started talking about relationship design and things like that, that really made so much sense to me. So maybe we can start with that. Tell us about what is solo? How did you start the solo movement? Just let's dive into that topic.
Well, yeah, certainly I didn't start the movement. I feel like I joined the movement. The movement has been around probably since the first person to resist an arranged marriage. You know, so I think it probably goes back, 4,000 years or so, in a sense. But I would say that it is catching, getting some steam. It's catching on a lot more. The more recent history work by Bella DiPaolo, in particular, a fellow behavioral scientist, has been writing extensively on this and myth busting for 20 plus years. When I actually started the podcast, I was kind of voraciously consuming any singles related book that I could find. So a bunch by Bella, for example. There's a lot of memoirs out there. There's a few kind of sociological, kind of academic books, sort of written for a popular audience. But a friend of mine, a fellow bachelor, gifted me this book called The Challenge of Being Single. And so I opened it up, I start reading, and it said something like, if you're one of the 47 million singles in the United States who are constantly blah, 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 facing all these challenges, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, when was this book written? And I like flipped to the publication page. It was written by two women, an academic and a journalist, in 1974. And I mean, now we have 128 million single adults in the United States, nearly one in two. The most common household in the United States is one person. Do you live alone?
I live with my kids half the time. The other
okay,
half
so you live alone. Yeah, so you're one of those households half the time. That's the most common household. And so I like read this book. I was a little deflated because they were talking about many of the same issues that I was talking about on this new podcast, except I was talking about them in a more positive way. So if they were writing the book today, they would probably write The Opportunity of Being Single. And that's really what the solo podcast is about.
Do you think most people are there though to think about it that way?
No, they're not. And part of the reason is there's no one pointing out the opportunities of being single. And certainly not pointing out that it should be equivalent to partnered living, that it's no better or worse. It's just different. And And that really was my goal as someone who had with time become comfortable, not just comfortable with his singleness, but actually found it to be a very good state for me to be in. I like to say I'm not anti-marriage. I just think it's overprescribed. And so, so I launched the podcast to start sharing that message. And then, I mean, it's completely changed my life. I mean, it's, I have a whole different perspective, a whole new language, a whole new approach to my own dating life, and my approach to relationships more generally. So the episode on relationship design you were talking about, I could never have published that episode, you know, close to 3 years ago when I got involved in the movement. But I too read about relationship anarchy and thought, wow, what a cool idea. What a bad name. And felt that, like, you know, like many things, it needed a little bit of sprucing up, so to speak. But, you know, the basics of that idea, that is that rather than defaulting into a particular script, a particular agreement, a particular set of rules for a relationship, romantic or otherwise, you should co-create them with the other person or persons, and regularly revisit them, those agreements, those rules, in a way that continues to let the relationship exist, be healthy, not always grow, to be honest. You know, it doesn't, you know, not every relationship has to be growth oriented, per se, doesn't have to be building to something, but one where both people opt in rather than default in. And I don't know how much you have talked about the relationship escalator on this podcast, but that was an idea that I had never heard of and now talk about all the time.
Yeah, I don't believe I've talked about it. I would love to have you explain that. Mm-hmm. And before you do that, or maybe as part of that, can you explain what do you see as the difference between single and solo?
Yes. Okay. Again, I had no distinction between single and solo. I'm very fortunate to have a small community of people who have come together around the podcast, and they're really wonderful. You know, they're smart, they're articulate. I actually, in my forthcoming book, have some of their voices. So I have, in between each chapter, I have two solo love letters. So these are members of the community talking about their single life, just because I recognize that my experience won't resonate with most people. And so I wanted to have a voice that has a chance to resonate. And so one of those members of the community was sort of pointing out that I sort of didn't have a good definition of solo. And it forced me to kind of do the work to figure out what is the difference between being single, which is about relationship status, and being solo, which is about identity. And in many ways, the solo movement, in my opinion, is about transcending relationship status, that you are not what your relationship is. And frankly, you know, the data bear this out. Knowing whether someone is married or single tells you almost nothing about their happiness. Almost nothing. And it may tell you a lot about their lifestyle. It may tell you a lot about their opportunities. It may tell you a lot about their goals in some ways, but it tells you very little about how good their life is,
and
in a sense.
You know, just because someone is in a relationship or a marriage is no guarantee to happiness, like you said. You know, I have a good friend who lives in London, and she's a similar age to me, and she's never been married, never had kids. And, you know, we're both single, but I have been married and have kids. And, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about, you know, she kind of had this like idyllic version in her head. If I just get married, my life is going to be so happy. And I was like, well, I was married for 12 years. And, you know, that was not a good relationship. It wasn't a bad relationship, like he wasn't a bad person, but it wasn't a fulfilling relationship. And I think a lot of people don't think about that. They think you get married and you're done, like you're good for life.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a recipe for a bad marriage, because for that relationship to work, both people have to be working on it, growing, improving, mm-hmm. and I would say continually negotiating the rules and agreements rather than just opting into the ones, defaulting into the ones that the world gives us. And we'll talk about those. So a quick bit of, if I could put on my, you know, my professor jacket with the, you know, the elbow patches on the sleeves, you know, the data on this is really fascinating. So the pro-marriage crowd would tell you, and your friend assumes this to be the case. It's obviously perpetuated by the media of happily ever after. And so what the pro-marriage crowd will say is that the research that looks at the happiness of married people finds that indeed married people are happier than single people, who are happier than divorced people. Okay. Now, first of all, those differences are rather small, but because the data are based upon thousands, 10,000s, hundreds of thousands of people, it is statistically significant. So you can detect it. It's a real difference. But in my opinion, it's not a meaningful difference. And so what the pro-marriage crowd will infer from this and shout very loudly is that you should get married and stay married and be happy. Okay. There's two other problems with that, besides the fact that those happiness differences are rather small. To show that happiness difference between married people and singles, you need to remove the divorced people from the sample, which seems like cheating for me if you're telling people to get married as a path to happiness. With a 33% divorce rate in the United States, that's a non-trivial chance that at some point it won't work out.
It's 33%. I thought it was
5%. It is 33%, more or less. The reason people think it's 50% is because the way the divorce rate is calculated is that it compares the number of marriages in a year to the number of divorces in a year. And so it's not an apples to apples comparison. So, but I mean, you know, whether it's 50% or 33%, it's not trivial that ends up happening. The other thing is, and this is really fascinating, is of course you can't actually show causality, right? You can't show that marriages cause happiness because you can't run an experiment, right? So I'd love to be able, as a behavioral economist, run that experiment where I randomly assign people to marriages and randomly assign them to divorces and randomly assign people to never get married, even though they want to, and see how their lives turn out. I just can't get that past my human subjects committees at my university. But you could do a proxy for that. And that is, you can look at those same longitudinal studies and you can look at people's happiness before they get married. And what you see is fascinating. What you see is that the people who get married and stay married are already slightly happier than singles. Which, and the people who get married and get divorced are slightly less happy than singles. Again, not meaningful in my opinion, but yet those effects persist. And so that changes the story, which is that it just might be easier to stay married if you're a little bit of a happier person in general. Right? I'm more satisfied with your life in general. And so I don't think that the pro-marriage folks have a very strong case when it comes to happiness in that sense.
I feel like there's a just natural human tendency, and I have nothing to back this up, but that people want other people to do the same thing they're doing. So people who are married feel like everyone else should be married, and people who are single feel like everyone else should be single. I don't know. Is there truth to that?
I think so. I would say this. I think that the first statement is certainly correct. I think that the second statement has some degree of veracity. I think it's unpopular to tell people that they should be single, right? Like, I don't go to dinner parties with my married couples and being like, you know, I'm really rooting against you here. Hope you break up and join the singles crowd again, kind of thing.
Just say it for sure, but don't you think people think it?
Well, I think that if you are happily single it's very easy to feel like you're seeing the Matrix, right? I think you can start to see the mythology. You can start to see past what people are saying to realize that, you know, not every marriage is happy. And in the same way that not every single person is thriving, you know, and that's what I mean by knowing whether someone is married or single tells you almost nothing about how happy they are. That for some people, marriage is, and their particular partner is the best thing to ever happen to them. And they would really be lost without them, that it provides meaning, it provides structure, that parenting really works well for them, and so on. It just, you know, unfortunately doesn't agree with people enough, given the high rates at which people do this. In 1960, 90% of people would go on and get married, right? So it just, almost nothing hits rates like that. You know, and so I, as you know, as someone who teaches marketing, knows about what we call heterogeneity, which is just that there are differences in people's tastes, in their lifestyle, in their goals. And so almost nothing is that popular. And obviously, marriages are no longer that popular as a result of, you know, changes to culture, especially.
So I think that leads us right into the topic of the relationship escalator, because everything that you're talking about and what we're framing this conversation around is this expectation of society to have this escalator of how a relationship would go. So can you talk a little bit about that topic?
Yeah, certainly. And I think it helps to understand the escalator if you're going to understand the four types of singles. All right. So I'm going to give you a quick lesson. When I say you, I mean your listeners, a quick lesson on the relationship escalator. But they already know it. They just don't know what it's called, and they've never had the stages and the rules articulated very clearly to them. But many of them have ridden it fully or partially. Their parents probably have. Their siblings might have. It's portrayed in movies and books and love songs. It is the default high status romantic and sexual relationship that is assumed to be the goal. And as if you listen to the pro-marriage crowd, we'll make you happy. We'll provide fulfillment in your life. And the stages are, you know, you meet someone, you flirt, you go out on a date, catch some feelings, probably have sex. At some point you define the relationship. It becomes exclusive, i.e. monogamous. You meet the friends, you meet the family, you move in with one another, you merge your lives. You may get married, that's less the case now, but you certainly are a partnership. Kids may follow, you may end up buying a house, you know, the American dream. And it ideally ends with one of you dying. Right? That's the relationship escalator. Now, the rules of the escalator are, there's three categories of rules. I've already mentioned one, and it's the 800-pound gorilla of rules, and that is consistent sexual and romantic monogamy. That is, this is a relationship in which the relationship is closed except to one other person, and you do not share romance or sex with anyone else outside of it. By the way, spoiler alert, it doesn't guarantee sex or romance within the relationship, as many people find out at some point. I tell a story in my book about a friend of mine whose mother just decided one day, no more sex with dad. You know, no more. And I asked her, I said, oh, well, is he allowed to take a lover? Can he hire a sex worker? Or when? And she looked at me like I was a degenerate. Like, are you kidding me? No. You know, because this is the rule that they abide by. I've mentioned a second rule already, which is merging. You merge your lives. You move in together. You merge your living arrangements. You often merge your identity. You start using the word we. We need a vacation. Right? You know, I call it the benefication of a relationship. You know, so two become one in identity. And then You merge your lifestyles. Typically, you start to vacation together. You get on a similar schedule. You take on some similar kinds of hobbies. Sometimes the things that you were doing before that don't fit get dropped away. And often a lot of compromise flows from that merged life, in a sense. And then the last rule is hierarchy. That is that this is to be the most important adult-adult relationship in your life. The only relationship that may be more important is an adult child, that between parent and child. Well, going down, not always going up, right? So I had a friend who was recently married. We were talking about his funeral. Don't ask me why. We were talking about funerals. We're getting to that age, I guess. And he just matter-of-factly said, my wife is going to plan my funeral. And I said, but what about your mother? Right. You know, and he's like, no, it's going to be my wife. And so that's hierarchy thing. And that hierarchy often comes with wide ranging veto power over what you do, who you do it with, and so on. And so the relationship anarchist, or the relationship designers, as I would say, are keen to be aware of those rules and not just blindly accept them. And instead, if someone's creating a romantic partnership, one that's designed to be long-term, you would discuss those. Should we move in together, right? Are we going to merge our identities? Will this be a monogamous relationship, sexually and or romantically? Is this relationship going to always be the most important? What happens if my childhood friend of 35 years needs me to fly cross country to help him for a month? You know, would that be okay, you know, for me to do? Where the rules of the escalator would probably say no, not okay, you know, to do that. As well as all these other little agreements about things like goodnight text and separate bedrooms and holidays with the family and so on and so forth. It's a pretty long list of, and a lot of conversations when you move out of that that standardized agreement.
I want to talk for a minute about the concept of veto power over someone else's life, because one of the things I was thinking about when I listened to your podcast and some of the questions I actually had for you that I was thinking about, and I don't know if you've addressed these in your other episodes or not, I think that ability to give someone veto power over your life is what scares most people away from or prevents people from wanting to have a relationship. And I think one of the things that's, you know, one of the most prevalent characteristics of dating, modern dating today, lots of fuckboys, lots of ghosting, lots of, you know, what we would in the past not think of as good behavior to treat another person is now really acceptable. And I was thinking about how it ties back to the fact that people see this escalator and they think that this is the only thing and they don't want it, but because they don't have context or framework to think about what else could there be, and they know they don't want to have this path and they don't want to give this veto power to someone else, it by default creates a lot of this really poor behavior. So I was curious your thoughts on that. Do you think that that's almost a byproduct of the escalator being the predominant social norm and people not knowing how to do something different?
I think that's a wise observation. Let me talk about the four types of singles, and then I'll address it in the fourth type, because I've talked about it slightly differently than you have. And I think that I want to develop my thinking about this as I talk about it.
Yeah. And I just want to say that I'm saying this in the context of, I'm bisexual, so I date women, but I primarily date men.
Okay.
So this is primarily my observation of almost, I will say, the majority of men that I have interacted with through dating apps are generally of the mindset of, I don't want anything serious. A lot of ghosting, I think, occurs from that. And so, you know, a lot of what I talk about in this podcast is trying to figure out, like, why is that? Why is that so normalized? And it kind of came together for me when thinking about this, just discussed. But
I think, Well, what I would like to say is I believe I have a different playbook, whether it be for men, women, straight, gay, or otherwise. But it's a very vulnerable playbook to play because it demands a lot of honesty. And it demands, well, it demands honesty with oneself about what you want. And then it demands honesty with other partners. And I think what's sorely lacking is certainly the honesty with other partners. This is what I think a lot of your listeners' experience has been, in a sense. And then associated with other also bad behavior on top of it, which really is very painful. So the four types of singles. The first type I call someday singles. These are people who very clearly want to ride the relationship escalator. They want to ride it till the end. You know, they see that as a path to a fulfilling life, to a good life, and in some ways, a righteous life. I mean, this is a morally charged relationship. It is a high status relationship, not just within your life, but within society, right? It receives 1,000+ legal benefits. It receives the approval of friends and family, and it's a desirable state. And so the some days are waiting and hoping, sometimes hopelessly, for this to happen. And they're striving and struggling to make it happen. Charlotte on Sex in the City is very clearly a someday single, right? She only dates men who she sees there being some future possibility with. And I think the average person is a someday. You know, they don't have any other way to think about it, you know, and they're just sort of doing the best they can.
Yeah, I would say almost all my single female friends are some days.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's see if we can convert them into just maze, which is the second category. So now once we move into the second categories, now we're talking about solos. Now we're not talking about relationship status per se. We're talking about identity. And I like to say that solos have three elements to their lives. The first and most important is that they see themselves as a complete person. I say they're wholehearted. They don't feel like half a person. They don't feel incomplete till their better half comes along. And I remember the moment I became wholehearted. I was going through a very upsetting breakup. The woman, I didn't do anything wrong per se. We just wanted to be together, but couldn't because of our mismatch goals. And I remember exactly where I was standing in my apartment where I had this realization, which was, I'm happy when I'm single. You know, that there wasn't this void that needed to be filled. And for as wonderful as she was, I call her the fashionista, as wonderful as the fashionista was, she wasn't going to solve my problems, you know. And I had plenty. I still do. We all do, you know. But that was not her responsibility, and that's not what she would have been good about anyways. And I just remember thinking, like, I'm going to be okay. My life as a single person is good. It's healthy. It's happy. I love my work. I love my friends. I'm on a growth path. You could just write down all of those things. So that's the first one. You don't see yourself as incomplete. The second one is that solos tend to embrace their autonomy, their self-sufficiency. That is, they seek to solve their own problems. I like to say they're a good parent to themselves. They don't need someone to take care of them. Or at least they're striving to do that. It's not easy, you know? I mean, I certainly wasn't there early in my life. I had a great deal of financial and housing insecurity as a young man. And I understand why coupling up can help solve that problem, right? You know, you share expenses and so on. You have a second income as a hedge, you have someone to support you, and so on. So solos seek that self-sufficiency, but they don't seek to isolate themselves. They're often building a community around themselves in order to support themselves, friends, family, chosen family, and so on. And then the last one is that solos tend to be unconventional thinkers. They recognize the escalator. They see its pluses and minuses. They question the rules. You know, they question the rules about, is this right for me? And by extension, they tend to question the rules more generally. Right? You know, so the world wants us to behave in certain ways. And in many ways, the rules benefit society more than the individual, right? The invention of marriage was not invented for personal fulfillment. It was invented to try to create a stable society. It was invented because of land ownership. It was invented to create alliances. And in many ways, it made especially women's lives worse off. They were turned into property. So recognizing that the rules aren't always designed for you in mind can be very liberating. So it just may, a solo, may want the relationship escalator. They just don't feel less than until it happens. They're not living in this liminal temporary world waiting hopelessly. They're getting on with their lives. Right? Carrie and Miranda from Sex and the City are kind of just mazed. They're open to this partnership, but they are not waiting around for it to happen. And so even just shifting folks to that mindset, even though their goal remains largely the same, I think is a really liberating place to be, in part because you don't know if it'll ever happen. And it may take years. And who wants to live less than for all those years? And for anyone who's ever gone into a relationship, good, bad, or ugly, you recognize that you give up stuff in order to do it. And everything you give up is not always something you want to give up. And so see it as a different path, but don't see it as better or worse is the takeaway. The next group are the no ways. And this is a stunningly large group. I like to say I'm 20% no way. I'm not always dating. I'm rarely in a steady relationship, at least a steady romantic one. Pew Research Center finds that, so as I said earlier, half of American adults are single. Pew Center finds that half of them are currently not interested in dating or a relationship at the moment. So that should be really heartening to some of your listeners, which is that it's just as typical, it's just as normal, quote unquote, to want a relationship as it is to not want one. And what's fascinating about this research, it shows that the reason that people don't want it is largely positive. That is that they're working on more important things in their life. They're busy relocating to a new city. They're starting a new job. They're in a graduate program. They're building a business. They're working on themselves. They're just doing other things that they deem more important than dating and their pursuit of a relationship, casual or the escalator. And I think that's there's almost no conversation around them, right? They're not portrayed in movies. They're not love songs about them and so on. And so if you're one of those no ways, you can feel like there's something wrong with you, but it's actually really quite common.
And I think it's actually a lot healthier to acknowledge you're not ready or don't want a relationship than to try and be in a relationship when you probably shouldn't be because you're doing self-work or that's not your priority.
Yes. I'm working on an episode. I'm really going to take my time with it called So You're Divorced. What's Next? And a lot of that conversation is going to be built around don't default into looking for a relationship right away. This is a wonderful opportunity to reflect, to make change, to pursue growth. And if you want to have another relationship, to be better prepared for a new relationship. But I think a lot of divorced people just re-up, so to speak, and they get back into the dating world, and it's overwhelming because they've been out of it for so long. And suddenly, you know, what worked back in the day when they're in their 20s and 30s doesn't work now in their 40s and 50s. And, you know, yeah, swipe culture.
I can personally attest to that. That was my story. When I came out of my 12-year relationship, which was a marriage, I immediately thought I need to jump into a relationship. And I had a lot of sort of painful lessons around that not working out for me that led me on this journey of discovering at the end of it, relationship design, and realizing that that's actually not what I want. But it took me a long time to shift my own mental landscape and focus, and just understanding of how people connect to get there.
Yeah, wonderful. And also, you know, if you've been living in a monogamous life, you might be excited for some non-monogamy. You know, I get the reasons that people do it. I just want them to take a deep breath and know what they're getting into and to take care of themselves first. So the last group, they're the smallest group, arguably the sexiest group, certainly the fastest growing group, is the new way solos. So let's back up, and we'll talk about me for a moment, because I consider myself a new way. I suspect you are a new way. That is that there are many people who struggle dating. They have difficulty dating because they don't want the full escalator experience. So for me, I've never wanted children, for example. That has gotten in the way of a lot of relationships, but not nearly as much as the fact that I realized that I don't want to live with someone. Right? So I had a couple in my late 30s, early 40s, painful breakups with really wonderful women who we had healthy, happy relationships, where one day, about a year and a half into the relationship, they said, this is separately, not together, separately, Peter, I want to move in. And I did not want to lose them, but I also didn't want my partner to live with me. I don't foresee that happening in my life. Things can change, but certainly right now, I don't want to live with anyone. I don't even have a living thing in my apartment. I've got a plastic plant. So I want to be able to leave the house and not have to come back. Is, you know, I fly on one-way tickets now. It's like one of the things that I really enjoy doing as a solo. And for many years, many, many years, I thought there was something wrong with me because I couldn't make the escalator work. And by the way, lots of things wrong with me. But when I looked at all my other relationships in my life, my relationship with colleagues, my relationship with family, my relationships with friends, these are longstanding, healthy, good relationships. Like I wasn't broken as a person. And it wasn't even the case that I couldn't, quote unquote, commit. I mean, I could do that. I just didn't want the same thing. And what the big realization, and there may be people listening to this right now who are realizing this, is like, oh, there's nothing wrong with me. There's something wrong with the escalator. There's something wrong with merging. There's something wrong with the hierarchy. There's something wrong with monogamy. There's something wrong with the consistency. Whatever that thing is, and you live in a world, as you talk about, where most people want this thing. They don't even question the rules of it. And that creates a lot of friction when you go out on dates with them. So I think that for me was incredibly liberating. And relationship design in many ways flowed from recognizing that if you're going to have an unconventional relationship, you need to have a model by which to talk about co-creating that, creating that container together where your unconventional relationship is unique rather than picking from a menu. What you've identified, which I think is very interesting, is that that some of the bad behavior that happens in the world of dating is that someone portrays themselves as wanting the escalator and misleading someone, and then stepping out, stepping away, wanting to change the rules, whatever that is. So, for example, someone who just wants a casual sexual relationship, which, by the way, I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting a casual sexual relationship. As long as you don't say to someone, I want a serious relationship, use that person for sex, and then disappear on them. That is... I can't even think of the worst word I can think of for that. It's, you know, it's completely inappropriate. It's awful. It's unethical behavior. It's immoral. You're causing harm when you do that. And so to me, the solution has been, first of all, don't assume that everybody wants the escalator unless they tell you they want the escalator. You're going to have to get really honest with yourself about what you do want. And then you're going to have to get honest with your partners. So, for example, when I go out on dates or in my dating profiles, depending on what the nature of it is, I'm very clear I don't want to have children. I'm very clear that I don't want to live with a partner. I'm very clear if I'm having sex with other people, and so on and so forth. And, I find that I'm heterosexual. The women I go out with are thrilled to hear someone be honest with them, even if they're not happy with what I have to say, right? Even if they want to ride the escalator, they may not agree that that's what they want. They're appreciative of the honesty. And I think a lot of times people will surprise you because they'll say, I'd rather go out with you on a Friday night than sit home alone.
So one of the things that I've struggled with, I'm currently in a place where I am actually only looking for casual relationships or play partners. So I have a few people in my life like that, and I've had a couple of relationships like that with men. And what's been interesting to me is even when it starts off that way, and I think the answer to this is relationship design, but because it's not a, you know, well-known concept, people don't really know how to go about it, is that I feel like when you go out of the escalator and you even start up front with saying this is going to be a casual relationship, there's kind of almost like no rules. Mm-hmm. And so to a lot of people, that kind of means, well, I can treat you however I want because it's casual. So I don't need to make plans with you in the future, or I don't have to have, you know, consistent communication with you. So for me personally, the way I solve that is that I tell people up front, I have core relationship values, which are, mutual effort, consistent, it doesn't have to be consistent communication like all the time, but that's, there's effort back and forth with communication. The communication is clear, especially around making plans and things like that. Mm-hmm. Consideration of my time. So being considerate of my time, taking my time to be as valuable as your time. And then safety. So, you know, that's kind of what I say up front that I'm looking for. But, you know, I have, before I was able to really articulate that, I kind of struggled with like, okay, we're outside the escalator, but we didn't know there was an escalator. And so, you know, kind of how do you treat this? And are we playing from the same, book of rules?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to compliment you on having such clarity about what is important to you. In these, because to me, casual does not mean non-important. I actually don't like the word casual.
I agree, but I think it does to a lot of other people.
Yes. I think casual and serious, I really dislike that language. I sometimes use it because it, normal people, not people like me who've spent thousands of hours thinking about this stuff, they get it. But I think that conversation and being very clear. So not only are you clear about what you want, you're very good about articulating it, and having that person agree that they will do that is, I think, very important. In part because it provides clarity. Should they be unable, the sex may be great, but they're poor communicators. The sex may be great, but they cancel last minute on you. You know, these kinds of things that are sometimes really hurtful, sometimes just annoying, or it even just suggests that that person's not as committed to the relationship as you are. I certainly am involved in regularly revisiting these kinds of conversations. I often do them by checking in, which is, how are you feeling about this? It's funny because some people are not used to that, right? So they're like, is everything okay? Right? I'm like, so how are you feeling about us? They're like, is everything okay? Are you going to break up with me? What's going on? You know, kind of thing. Because people don't talk about things when they're good often. I certainly had a conversation along the lines with a partner who I would say is tough to wrangle. You know, doesn't always respond to text messages. And I have kind of come to the, we've come to the place where she sort of knows anytime she wants to propose getting together, I'll do my best to accommodate that. Occasionally I'll reach out to see if she's available, but I just find that sometimes I just don't hear back. And it's just her style of communication with a phone, the nature of her lifestyle. But I really adore my time with her. When I'm with her, she is 100% present. Like she's just such great company. But at one point in time, I said to her, I said, listen, you know, this was in person. I'm thrilled to see you today. You know, I'm really excited to see you today. I have a request for you, and that's this. If you ever decide that you don't want to see me again, will you agree to tell me? And I promise you, I won't try to talk you out of it. I won't be mad. I'll thank you for it. We can reminisce and so on. But I want to know that, because if I send you a text and I don't hear from you for 10 days, I don't want to be wondering, will I ever hear from you again? Mm-hmm. You know? And she was so wonderful about it. She said, actually, I was talking to a friend of mine about you the other day, and I said, at some point when this relationship ends, I expect to be Peter's friend. I think we'll always be friends. And I was so moved by that. You know what I mean? Like, I was so touched by that sentiment. And she said, yeah, I will let you know. And I was like, wonderful, you know? And so if I hadn't had that conversation, if I hadn't had that vulnerability, we would have just kept playing out this situation where I'm kind of waiting and hoping for her to respond to my text messages that are there.
And I've actually talked about this a lot on other episodes too. And I think part of the issue is that there's no education around how to have these kind of conversations. Mm-hmm. There's nothing we learn that this is how to be a good partner. This is how to show up in a relationship for someone else. And everybody has a different definition of that. But I think the truth is people are just really bad at it because they don't practice doing it. And so It's like the default to not talk about things and to not have clarity. And everyone kind of has their own thing in their head. And you have no idea if your things match up or in alignment unless you actually talk about it.
Yes. I mean, I think what we're doing right now is that we're helping people learn that there's a different set of scripts that are out there. I mean, I'll be very clear. I mean, here's the problem is that the people who are behaving this way aren't listening to your podcast, but maybe people will send this on to someone who behaved badly. But the issue is this is, if all you want is casual sex, right? If all you want is a play partner, if you only want friends with benefits, or if you only want to be able to booty call someone, you need to say to them, this is what I want. What I want to be clear about is, like, as long as there's no harm and as long as there's consent, two or more adults can do whatever they want with each other. And I'm not going to put any moral labels on it as being right or wrong, as being better or worse, but I think a lot of people are avoiding those hard conversations. They're not willing to be vulnerable. They're not willing to, as I like to say, ask for what they want.
Yeah, I agree with you. That makes a lot of sense. I want to talk about this from a different perspective. Specifically around women who want children. Are you familiar with the book Datanomics?
I'm not, no.
So I heard about this on a podcast I listened to, Girls Gotta Eat podcast. Not sure if you're familiar with that, but they had a woman on their podcast who wrote a book about why women freeze their eggs. Mm-hmm. And she's done the largest anthropological study on this. So she interviewed over 150 women. And what she learned is that this stereotype of why women freeze their eggs is because they want to climb the corporate ladder and they want to focus on their career. And she found, without exception, except for women who had cancer at a very young age, 100% of the women were freezing their eggs because they couldn't find a male partner who wanted to have children with them. So then they started talking about this book, Datanomics. I think I forgot when it was written, but essentially that the dating landscape has changed significantly from an economic perspective, where women are now more educated than men, you know, becoming more successful than men, having better careers than men, making more money than men. And they're having a really hard time, like economically, finding a male partner that, first of all, is at the, you know, perceived level that they want them to be in terms of education, success, and career. And secondly, that actually want to have children. And, you know, when I heard this, and I obviously already have kids. I don't want to have more kids. I never want to get married again. But I do have a lot of single female friends who are in this place where they really do want to have children, get married, you know, they're late 30s, early 40s. And it's, you know, the chances of that becoming smaller and smaller. And so I think we're at this really interesting point in time where, you know, monogamy has been the social norm for, you know, hundreds, thousands of years, or however long, you know, since it first got introduced by the church, by religion. And people are starting to break out of that. So they're starting to say, what else is out there? We're seeing a lot more polyamory, you know, ethical non-monogamy, all these like keywords that we hear. But we're not quite to the point where it's shifted yet to say what replaces that. And again, I think going back to relationship design is almost kind of the answer to this. But because, again, people don't have the language or the ability or the education to talk about this, I think it presents a real dilemma for women who do want to have children. You know, and obviously women can have children on their own. You know, we all know that, but it is really hard. And I'm a single mom half the time. Thank God my kids are older, 10 and 12. But at the end of my week with my kids, I'm always like, I'm not meant to do this by myself. Like, this is so much work. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
My goodness, where do I begin? I certainly have a lot of compassion for the single moms out there. My mother was a single mom full time. Incredibly challenging. I have a lot of sympathy for women who really want to make this happen and are having trouble doing so. I had Melanie Notkin on my podcast. She has a book called Otherhood about women who want to be mothers, but can't, but they are serving that role in other ways as aunts and community members and so on, helping uplift children's lives, and how just painful, how awful that must be to have this thing that you want to do and be unable to do it. How heartbreaking it is with this, you know, metaphorical clock, you know, ticking loudly. And I think a lot of these women are, I suspect from this interview, if you have the means by which to freeze your eggs, you're often winning at life in every other way. And for a lot of these women, the more they're winning at life, the more difficult they're having finding this partner. I've been paying more attention to this topic. It's starting to bubble up. Women are starting to talk about the struggles of men. I say you know, that men are unpopular right now. You know, everybody wants to smash the patriarchy, but they don't realize how the patriarchy is only beneficial to a small number of men. That, you know, the average man is not living this wonderful life. You know, issues, you know, you can go through all the things, home, you know, men are disproportionately homeless, suicidal, incarcerated, deaths of despair are are overwhelmingly men. And women are just outpacing men in all these ways, educationally, in a lot of economic ways. And the world has not shifted, you know, in terms of economically, manufacturing, et cetera, to let, you know, men find ways to thrive in this sort of new reality. And it doesn't help having pornography readily available in video games and living in a parent's basement. I'll be perfectly honest with it. And so I think it's a very difficult situation because there are a lot of men who would like to have a wife and can't find a woman willing to be with them because they're not appealing. You know, they haven't done the hard work and they haven't evolved. And so we have, you know, in a heteronormative sense, these genders who are sort of mismatched and a lot of suffering that's happening as a result of it. I'm trying to do my part in two ways. One is to point out that your single life, should you, you know, you be single by chance, rather than single by choice, for example, not be a life that's less than, right? That, you know, that there, that even if you don't end up becoming a mother, or finding a life partner, that doesn't mean that your life's not worth living. That there are many ways to find personal growth, to find meaning, to thrive, as I say, to live remarkably. And that might be through art, it may be through community involvement, it may be through your family, it might be, as Melanie has done, you know, outside of the norms of motherhood. And so I want people to, A, realize that their singleness provides opportunity, and then point out that there are many ways to contribute to a world and find personal and professional fulfillment outside of this very narrow tract, which is to ride the escalator till death do you part.
Yeah. And the reason I say, I think relationship design is an answer to this is because I think we need to get to the point where we look beyond the traditional family. Mm-hmm. And I think you had a woman on your podcast who was planning to have a child in a somewhat unusual situation. And I think you can definitely design a relationship around parenthood that is outside mm-hmm. of a traditional escalator. And I think that that is what people who can't find, who, you know, who either don't want to be in the escalator, but still want to have a family, or, you know, people who have children already and are now divorced or single, you know, the idea of children and family is not readily fit into the model necessarily. And I don't think that the way we've always done things is the answer either, but I don't think there's necessarily, you know, a norm to replace it with yet.
I agree. You know, I think these new way solos are our best hope. So it's very easy to pay attention to the ones who are doing polyamory or ethical non-monogamy or, you know, all this kind of stuff. But some of these people are doing platonic partnerships, right? So their life partner is someone that they have no romantic or sexual feelings for. And they share the same house. They might have hierarchy. You know, they've opted into these kinds of things. The world's not built for them, right? So I say the world's built for two, but it's really built for a particular type of two. And so we're going to need to see changes to the law, to zoning, healthcare regulations, et cetera, to allow these different types of permutations. It's funny because these pro-marriage advocates are like, they're obsessed with this sort of nuclear family model. But the nuclear family model is not a very good model. It's really isolating. It's incredibly risky, right? Because someone goes away due to divorce or disability or death, and now it just fractures. In some ways, one of the things that is good about the good old days weren't that good, is these sort of extended family models that existed that were, they were kind of tribal. I mean, we're tribal people. You know, most of humanity has been spent in tribes, small groups of people that involve, yes, lovers, yes, kin, but also friends, you know, that everybody was united in a common goal. And so being able to recreate a family structure is super important for these folks who can't find the traditional. And I don't, you know, I know people like to point to these data that talk about like two parents and a kid and how good that is and so on. It's not really about two parents and a kid. It's about resources. It's about parents. It's about adults and stability. That's what it really, there's nothing magical about two parents and a kid. Mm-hmm. It's about a stable, healthy, happy household that has adults there that kids are going to be able to find a way to thrive in. And so to your point, I think relationship design allows people, it's not just about sex, right? You can use relationship design to create a Golden Girl scenario for you in your elder years. It's about communicating and agreeing and committing to someone and having that integrity to do what you say.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I keep thinking about is I have a friend who's poly. He's married. They have a daughter. He has a girlfriend. His wife has a boyfriend. He's bigendered. He does burlesque. And one of the things he said to me is, he's like, I don't know how monogamous people do it. He goes, how do you commit to just one person for the rest of your life? And I always think about that when, you know, when you're talking about like the new ways is why do people even want to do that in the first place, right? It's when you think about it from that perspective, one person for the rest of your life.
Well, you know, it's rewarded. You get to, you know, you get to celebrate it on Instagram. It is socially acceptable. You get invited to the dinner parties. You're part of the cool kids group. Your friend sounds like a lot of fun. And defies the stereotype of the selfish person who won't get married and settle down. You know, and I'm a little exhausted by how much he gives to all these relationships, right? Like he has a lot of intense, emotional, important relationships in his life. He is alive, you know? I think a lot of people who just default into this relationship and then take their foot off the gas are living, but they're not alive. And I think that one of the really exciting things about designing your relationship in the way that we've been discussing is that you have to be vulnerable. You have to take a risk. But boy, it gives you a chance to be alive with a partner. And I think that's, I hope that's the future, right? Where we can start to move past survival considerations, which is what a lot of marriage is designed to do, to finding a way to really feel not just like you're surviving, but you're alive.
Peter, to wrap up, I know that you have a personal story about being stood up and or ghosted. Can we talk a little bit about that before we end this episode?
Sure. I guess technically I was stood up and ghosted. So I met a woman on a dating app. And actually, I think we had not yet exchanged numbers. And I got a message from her that said, nice hat. And I couldn't put that together. And I was like, I don't follow. She had saw me out in the public, right, at a coffee shop. So I wear this Stetson Open Road hat. You know, it's part of a personal transformation. So I in Denver, I stand out. You know, people notice it. And I thought that was very funny. Oh, what, you know, through happenstance, we end up meeting at that very same coffee shop 2 days later. And she is lovely. You know, she's vivacious. I found her attractive. And she was like flirty and fun. And I think what ends up happening a lot with dating is you often play things safe because so often things don't go anywhere. And so you don't, you know, there's sort of the minimal investment available is what people often do at the beginning of something. And I was excited. I'll be honest. I was excited by her. And so I pitched some very fun dates for us to go on. You know, I had a good feeling. And one of those fun dates was to drive the Peak to Peak highway. So it's this very scenic highway to Estes Park. And we were going to have a drink at the Stanley Hotel. The Stanley Hotel is this old hotel in Estes Park. And it was the hotel that was inspiration for Stephen King's The Shining. And they do like ghost tours there and stuff like that. And she was, that sounds great. We picked a date. And then she sends me this text, a very exciting text that said, what time are we coming back the next morning? I've got like a meeting or whatever. And I thought to myself, oh, I didn't think it would be one of those kind of dates. And I said, we'll come back anytime you need to. I'm completely flexible. So I booked a room. And then while I was booking the room, I saw that they have a séance at the Stanley, an expensive séance. And I was like, I sent her a text and said, you know, they have a séance. Would you want to go to that? And she goes, more than anything else. So I booked two tickets for the séance. I was like, all right, we're going to live a little on a Thursday afternoon, you know, evening kind of thing. That day comes, send her a text in the morning, no answer. I go to the gym. I'm coming home from the gym. I'm thinking like, still no answer. I call her, said, hey, just checking in, you know, I'll be available to leave as early as 1 p.m. Never hear from her. So I texted a friend and be like, how long's appropriate to wait, you know, before? And my friend basically said, it's already been too long. You know, it's already been too long. So I ended up, this was humiliating. You know, it was already within the window that you can't cancel the hotel room. So I was going to eat the cost of the hotel. I was already going to eat the cost of the seance. There's no canceling that. And so I called the hotel and spoke to reservations. I said, listen, I'm a little bit embarrassed, but I had a date planned for the night and I'm being ghosted. Is there any way you can refund this room? I'm not going to need it. And the woman was very kind. She said, let me speak to my manager. And I think he'd been ghosted before or something, because she came back and said, I spoke to my manager. He said, it'll be okay. I'm going to remove the charge from your credit card. And I said, oh, thank you so much. And then I tried to salvage the seance because I was curious about this thing. I thought it'd be kind of fun, kitschy at the very least kind of thing. And so I ended up inviting someone else and we did the trip up and went to the seance and then came back that day. And, you know, we had a nice time. It wasn't a love connection, but it was a little bit of a adventure to have in light of that. But I was so affected by this. I was so perplexed and puzzled because sometimes when you look back, you can have seen the warning signs, but I had no warning signs associated with this. So I ended up actually doing a solo thoughts episode. I actually did an episode about getting stood up. And what I said, my conclusion, and I'm curious, maybe we can finish with your response to this. Maybe it'll help me, is that I said that a lot of times when people behave badly, what we want to do is say that they're a bad person. We want to say that they're an evil person and that they lack integrity and we want to diminish them in some way. That it's been my experience in life that when someone does something like that or behaves badly, it's often because of their weakness that they behave this way. They're not setting out to be mean. They just are misbehaving because they don't have what it takes to do the right thing in that. And that I found some solace in that idea that this wasn't a setup. So she wasn't laughing with her friends about doing this awful thing and how dumb I was and how excited I was by the prospects of this. And, you know, but rather she just, for some reason, got cold feet, decided I wasn't the right man for her. And rather than telling me that, she just decided to disengage from it. And it came from a place of weakness rather than malice.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there definitely are narcissists out there. And part of the narcissistic abuse cycle is ghosting, love bombing, mm-hmm. and then ghosting in the cycle. But I think that that is not the norm. And I was actually just talking to my therapist about this last week, because we were talking about the most recent person who ghosted me, which I talked about on my last episode. And I said almost the same thing to her. I said, I don't think he's a shitty person. I said, that's what he does, really shitty. But I said, I don't think he did it because he's a bad person. I said, he's immature, extremely selfish, and lacks the communication tools to have done what he should have done, which was just to send me a text message and say he wanted to end the relationship. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have the ability to do that. And at the end of the day, I feel like that's sad. It's sad that people are so lacking in just what it takes to be a basic good person. And again, I don't want to say they're bad people, but I guess basic, I think of almost more of it as like the ability to have empathy and think outside of your own uncomfortableness with having to take something back or say I made a mistake or, backtrack on something. They can't do it. And so, I feel like that's lacking on their end.
Thank you.
Well, Peter, this has been an incredible episode. I am so glad that you agreed to come on the podcast. So thank you so much. Can you tell our listeners where they can find everything about you, including information about your podcast and your upcoming book?
Sure. You can go to petermcgraw.org/solo. That's the starting point for the podcast. Some of my writing, you can join the solo community. The book is available for pre-order on Amazon and with its new title, Solo, Building a Remarkable Life of Your Own.
And listeners, you can find more about this podcast at theghostpodcast.com. If you would like to share a ghost story, you have feedback about this episode, you can send me an email at theghostpodcaststories@gmail.com. And you can also find me on Instagram at theghostpodcaststories and on TikTok at theghostpodcast. As always, thank you for listening.